from WNPR. I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
We saw Dow futures plunge well past the 800-point mark yesterday. They have since recovered.
Massachusetts voters legalized marijuana for recreational use Tuesday, sweeping away more than 100 years of prohibition and opening the door to a multi-billion-dollar industry from Provincetown to Pittsfield.
Republicans gaining some major victories on Election Day.
They will not only have control of the White House with Donald Trump as president-elect, but also both chambers of Congress for at least the next 2 years.
I've just received a call from Secretary Clinton. She congratulated us, it's about us, on our victory. And I congratulated her and her family on a very, very hard-fought campaign.
The voice of President-elect Donald Trump this morning on The Wheelhouse. You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. It's obviously an earth-shaking morning, and so we're glad to have Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show, as always here in The Wheelhouse. Hi, Colin.
The Cubs are still world champions, right?
Yes.
That didn't change?
I'm not trying to
sort out things that changed and things that didn't.
No, that's actually still in the books. Also with us here in our studio is Suzanne Bates. She's policy director at the Yankee Institute. Hello, Suzanne.
Good morning.
Joining us for a few minutes is Denise Merrill. She's Connecticut's Secretary of the State. And welcome back to the program, Secretary.
Thank you so much.
Joining us by phone is Kalila Brown-Dean. She's Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University. Hello there, Kalila.
Hi, John.
So what we're going to do is usually on a day like this, we'd spend a little bit of time right off the top talking with Denise Merrill about, you know, how did voting go and all those things. And we will get to that, I promise, in just a couple moments. But let's start with the really big news. I don't think, Colin, that any of us really thought that when we went to bed last night, we were going to wake up with a President Donald Trump.
It depends on what time you went to bed.
It depends on what time you went to bed. If you read the prognostications, if you looked, as many of us in our media circles do, at 538 in the New York Times Upshot blog, and you saw all of the polls that came in for weeks and months and even days and the minutes leading up until last night, you would have expected that Hillary Clinton would have pulled out perhaps a close but certainly a solid victory, taking all of the states that she was supposed to take and maybe a few she wasn't supposed to take, and we would wake up in an America that most people had predicted. But that is not what happened. What is your best sense as to why that didn't happen?
Well, yeah, first of all, I mean, one of the minor casualties of this is going to be political journalism and data journalism. I mean, both the old-fashioned shoe-leather political reporting and the sort of Nate Silver era reporting, it didn't work, right? I mean, it couldn't have been more wrong. I mean, I regard that among all the whole list of things that are going to be discredited and ripped to pieces as one of the lesser questions. But it is going to be, as we go along, it'll be a big question. First thing I want to say before I say anything else is one of the things I'm the least interested in is the kind of circular fire squads that are going to form right now as people run around looking for people to blame and stuff like that. I think a lot of negative energy is going to be wasted at a time when we need a ton of positive energy. It's inevitable, but I mean, to whatever degree it can be minimized. Look, the big mistake was that they nominated Hillary Clinton instead of Gandalf. Gandalf would definitely have won this election. You know, and the simplest way to talk about this, I said this to you a few minutes ago, John, is that it turns out this was an election which a lot of Americans wanted change. They had a ravenous appetite for change, and there was really only one food truck pulling into the parking lot. You know, and a lot of people looked past something that may have bothered them a little bit.
They didn't like a lot of the stuff on that food truck.
Right. Yeah. They
didn't
like,
it was food.
That's right. They didn't like everything that was on the food truck, but it was a food truck. And you know, there were people who were evangelical Christians who looked past the sexual morals of this candidate. There were people who, you know, are uncomfortable with white nationalism who decided to kind of, you know, turn a blind eye to that. But I mean, and it's all obviously alarming and upsetting to people. But I think that is sort of the simple answer, really, was there wasn't really a menu for change coming from the other side. And change turned out to be really important to a lot of people.
Suzanne?
I would agree. I think this was really a repudiation of the elite, you know, quote unquote. And I think that's true on the Democratic side and the Republican side. I mean, there were a lot of – I mean, it came out yesterday that George W. Bush and Laura Bush didn't vote for Donald Trump. They left their ballots, their presidential spot on their ballots empty. You know, there were a lot of Republican leaders who came out as never Trumpers. And yet, you know, Trump defied them as well as, you know, obviously the establishment on the left. And so I think there's a lot of questions today about what that means for both parties and for the country. But clearly, people were looking for change,
but
Colin said.
But I will say, but something that did happen, though, and they were talking about that a bit on Morning Edition on NPR this morning, which I found fascinating, is a number of the national Republicans, people who are in Senate races, people who are in gubernatorial races, people who are running for reelection, they, as much as they tried to run away from Donald Trump, they still managed to end up on his coattails. Somehow or other, despite what you just talked about, Suzanne, we actually ended up with an awful lot of Republicans drafting off of a guy that they were like, I don't want to be behind this truck at all. But yet somehow or other, they're in the fast lane.
Right. Well, and I think that has more to do with voters, right, than anyone in leadership or at the top. I mean, ultimately, people didn't want to listen to those leaders like they have in the past. They were angry at them. And so, you know, you saw Republicans riding coattails, Republicans who had said, I'm not sure if I'm voting for Trump or I'm not voting for Trump. I mean, it was a sweep. And so that says a lot. I mean, and it's funny because I was also listening to NPR this morning, you know, they started asking about what this means for the Republican Party. What does this mean for the Democratic Party? Mm-hmm. You know, well, they've been really kind of hammered across the board in terms of state races and national races. So
let me just introduce one factoid into this is courtesy of Jonathan McNichol. Comes from Boris Shore, a professor of political science at the University of Houston. But just to what Suzanne is saying. So Hillary Clinton had 1,400 endorsements from 1,917 possible Democratic state legislators. So that's about 73%. Donald Trump had 214 endorsements from Republican state legislators out of a total possible of 4,117. So 5% of Republican state – if these numbers are right, 5% of Republican state legislators in the country endorsed Donald Trump. That gives you maybe kind of a sense,
right.
Even if that number turns out to be slightly off, it gives you a sense of the kind of separation you're talking about, Suzanne.
Right. There was deep unease, not just in the Democratic Party, but in the Republican Party about Donald Trump.
But since we have a top Democratic elected official here with us, let's just talk about what Suzanne just said, Denise Merrill. I mean, what does this mean for the Democratic Party? We will have plenty of time to talk about what it means for the Republican Party, about how Speaker Paul Ryan will get together with Donald Trump or not, what we're going to see as far as leadership in a cabinet. But the Democratic Party took it pretty hard across the board on the chin last night, including here in Connecticut.
Including here in Connecticut, yeah. I think the real question for me in all of this is, if people aren't listening to their leaders, their elected leaders, Republican or Democrat, who are they listening to? And, you know, besides Donald Trump, who is like the figurehead for all this, seems to me the big winner of last night was probably social media. I feel like there was this secret undercurrent going on that people were listening to, and the first inkling I got of it was with our voter registration, because there came a point during the in the last month where Facebook put a banner across the top of Facebook saying, "Don't forget to register to vote." We had 40,000 people in Connecticut register to vote in a day and a half. So that tells me this is the new media, and that is somehow people – there was something that pollsters weren't able to get at there, and that's what I'm thinking. How do you harness that? What party is going to be able to plug into that?
Well, I think one question, and something that has been said an awful lot in the analysis over the course of the last couple hours, because it has only been a few hours, is that, you know, when pollsters ask – a question like, do you support Donald Trump, much like those Republican state legislators who were running away, you know, maybe you don't want to say to a pollster, yeah, I do support the guy who doesn't have anything positive to say about women or Latinos or blacks or Muslims, the man who got an endorsement from the KKK. I don't want to get in front of that. But at the end of the day, you go into a voting booth and you vote that way. And that's a problem with polling. It's something that there's a big blind spot for in America right now, it seems.
And we all know, because we all have Facebook pages and Twitter accounts and so forth, that there's definitely a very negative undercurrent out there. And people are not afraid to put that in the comments section of your Facebook page.
That's for sure. Kalila Brown Dean is on the phone with us from Quinnipiac University. I'd love your thoughts right now, Kalila.
So I think we have to be very clear when we talk about a repudiation of elites, when we talk about a demand for change. it's not elites writ large. So if you look at the economic breakdown of people who voted for Donald Trump yesterday, they are people that we would think of as being economic elites, people who make $60,000 and above, which to some people may not seem like a lot of money. But when we think about economically what it truly means to be working class or middle class, there is an economic air there. When we think about the demand for change, it is also in some ways a repudiation of the change that we're seeing across this country, an angst and a fear about changing demographics, about people feeling like there's no longer a place for them in our country, because we talk so much about racial and ethnic change. We talk about changes in the workplace. We talk about changes within communities. And so there's some type of change that people embrace, but overall it's about saying the America that I want does not look like it has a place for me. And so that vote yesterday wasn't just a vote for Donald Trump, but it was about a vote for embracing that vision of America.
Kalila, something that I talked about on my program next was a really interesting Wall Street Journal analysis of diversity changes across America. The places in America where we would see the most change as far as racial and ethnic diversity. So cities don't change all that much at all because they've always been very diverse places. But many places in outer ring suburbs and in rural areas, including in places like New Hampshire that went for Donald Trump last night and Northern Maine that went for Donald Trump last night, those are exactly the sort of places where that change clearly drew out more white working class voters who were, again, if there's a repudiation word, they were trying to repudiate that particular change that they're seeing in their neighborhoods.
I think it brought them out in record numbers. And if we look at that nationwide, but also within our state, of people who live in rural areas or suburban areas saying, I feel like the cities, the urban areas, are zapping all of our collective focus. I feel like they're taking away from our economic base, and no one's talking about the issues that I care about. So it doesn't mean that has to be the reality, but that perception is very strong. And so you hear people saying, if we are in an economic budget crisis within our city, I don't want to hear about what's happening in New Haven and Bridgeport. Let me know what you're going to do about Darien or about Cheshire. And so that kind of resentment filters at the local level of changing structures, of people feeling like their mobility patterns are changing, and not seeing that type of change at the grassroots level as something that they should be excited about. Instead, it becomes a challenge to their way of life.
I want to take a quick phone call from Arturo, who's calling from Hamden. And if you want to join us, 860-275-7266 in the wheelhouse. Arturo, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, John. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. So I was just like you guys. I'm pretty shocked. I'm a Democrat in Hamden. We had great turnout there and good outcomes, but it just didn't happen. I'll start first with a quick comment, which means, you know, I've seen a lot of sad people, you know, even at home, my 10-year-old and all that. And I would put a message out there that on a sad day or in a rough day like today, shocking day, it would be important to try to stay civil, not break relationships or engage in discussions. It seems like we went through a pretty passionate electoral season. And the passion seems to have taken over policy discussions that were more serious. And my question is about exactly what role did the media, do you guys think the media played in terms of trying to add information to inform people during the electoral process? Seems like the passions and the one-liners took more relevance in people's votes. And so going forward, how does the media, including social media, do you guys think could play a role in educating policy?
Well, so first of all, it's a great question, Arturo, and I really appreciate it. And Colin, I mean, this is something you follow about as closely as anybody. What do you say?
Well, you know, I teach this class at Trinity. They were here last night. One exercise that we did after the first debate, I went around the table and I said, tell me exactly how you consumed this debate. Tell me what devices were running, what things you were watching, not just, you know, and out of 15 people, no two people had exactly the same story. And this, you know, in terms of, you know, I did this, but I also had Twitter on, I did this other thing too. And this builds a little bit on Denise Merrill's point, which is that in a world of social media, you're able to kind of construct your own fact pattern, right? So if you're a Trump voter, you're getting – or a potential Trump voter, you're getting kind of a different set of facts. Or if you could imagine the information universe as a 100% phenomenon, probably most of us can only consume, say, 30% of it. So which 30% are you consuming? And it turns out people are consuming different 30%. And it is also absolutely true that in the world of social media, there's less vetting of information, and things that are manifestly untrue get circulated around a lot. So there are a lot of people who believe things that were easily disprovable would never survive the vetting process of legacy media, but they circulate very quickly on social media. But even setting those things aside, there are various things that are more or less true or are manifestly true, but you might know Suzanne might know different ones from what I know. Denise might know different ones from what Suzanne and I know. You have access to almost different universes of information or sub-universes. And that does. It creates – it's not like the old electorate where basically everybody looked at the same stuff and then talked about what it meant. People look at completely different things.
Yeah, and I actually brought up to our group today something that I read in the New York Times this morning. Paul Krugman, the noted Nobel laureate economist who writes for the New York Times – wrote something that, let's just say, struck me a little wrong, that went, and I'll paraphrase, that I couldn't believe this happened because neither me nor any of the people that I know who read the New York Times could possibly imagine a universe in which this happens. And I think, Denise Merrill, that gets quite clearly to Colin's point. As we live in our own universes, if we don't look outside that universe, it is very hard to tell what train is coming when. Not just a train to hit us, but a train to pick us up perhaps and take us somewhere else. And I think that that's actually really something that, if nothing else, we're going to have to learn out of this.
Yeah, and I'm not sure the first group or party that figures this out is probably going to be a leg up on everyone else. And, you know, just in my own world of – I've always assumed that it's good to get more people involved, more people voting, and suddenly there was this Facebook thing and Twitter, and they're all jumping into this. And suddenly I have to throw out all my speeches about how nobody's voting because, as you know, for years I've said the real crisis in voting is no one's voting, and suddenly it's not true.
And before I let you go, because we do have to take a break, and you were nice enough to come in here, is there anything else that you took away from what you saw at the polls in Connecticut that might help us tell the story of what we saw in the nation or in any of the races across Connecticut as well? I mean, what did you see that may help us get a little bit more information here?
Well, some of the things that didn't happen. I mean, there was all the talk about hacking and rigging, and none of that happened anywhere in the country as far as I can tell. I mean, I don't know entirely, but certainly here, very little talk about that.
But also very little talk about voter intimidation, about people standing outside polls and making people not able to safely go in. I said this on the air a couple times yesterday. I felt like everyone was very calm and happy. Yesterday was a day in which I felt like there was an awful lot of really good democracy going on and people were very civil to one another, despite what we thought might happen.
Exactly. And I don't know if that tells you that we were all listening to different ideas about what was going to happen. And, you know, there's a lot of conspiracy theories out there. But all that, you're right. It felt like all that went away and the whole country just came out and voted. And the only problems we had was really volume. I mean, we had machines breaking down because there were so many ballots going in them that they jammed up. And that
sometimes
sort of
people not waking up in time to get to the polls in places. That's going to happen anyway. What was the overall voter turnout, do you think?
It's probably somewhere between 75% and 78%, which is a little higher than usual, but but not, you know, as high as 2008, for example. But we still haven't counted all the Election Day registration ballots, which there were many more of them than I ever thought there'd be, something like 30,000, 40,000. We don't know yet.
Well, on a day when there's not maybe as much to talk about at the national level, we'll have you back and we'll talk about all the great stuff we always talk to you about and try to figure out whether or not we're going to get early voting here in Connecticut. You know all that fun stuff.
Oh,
sound good?
I can't wait.
Okay. Denise Merrill is Connecticut Secretary of the State. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks, John.
When we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Suzanne Bates from the Yankee Institute, Kalila Brown-Dean from Quinnipiac, our own Colin McEnroe, and a bunch of phone calls from you at 860-275-7266 on this day after this very, very shocking presidential election. What do you think about what happened? Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news, or really just the news of the last couple hours. Donald J. Trump is the president-elect of the United States. There are a lot of other races and interesting things, but that is not just the headline, but it's something that we're trying to grapple with here with you at 860-275-7266 with Suzanne Bates from the Yankee Institute, Kalila Brown-Dean from Quinnipiac University, who joins us by phone, and our own Colin McEnroe. You going to be talking about this afternoon, Colin, or got something else planned?
I think we just might. we're trying to – actually, Jonathan McNichol and I will be talking about this later today, what kind of show we're going to put together. We have some people already committed. The philosopher Michael Lynch is going to join us. I think he's very interested in sort of an initiative towards civility in civic life. David Folkenflik, the media critic for NPR, is probably going to join us. The person I'm the most interested in getting, and she and I have been tweeting back and forth this morning, is Azar Nafisi, the Iranian-American writer who wrote Reading Lolita in Tehran. She's had some really interesting things to say, things similar to what I believe, which is that this is really a time for unleashing some of the most positive, creative, imaginative, powerful, honest energies that we can possibly find. You know, obviously, this is a very dark moment for a lot of people. There's two responses. Either you give up or you find the very best parts of yourself and you put them to work on behalf of society. That's very much the argument I want to make today with Azar if she joins us, without her if she doesn't. And I want to make it again and again as we go forward.
Or if you're Paul Krugman, you can blame Jill Stein for it. Right. Oh, no, I'm sorry. We won't talk about that anymore. Let's instead go to John in Hartford. Hey, John, go ahead. You're on the wheelhouse.
Hi, good morning. So I would describe myself as a sort of a left-leaning conservative or a right-leaning liberal. I haven't figured out. I don't really know. But my comment is on your guest from Quinnipiac University, the researcher who was commenting on what she thought was happened last night.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest with you, I find the problem, a lot of the problem with you, the talking heads and the press, it's incredibly clear that the researchers and pollsters got it flat out all wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you're listening to what she has to say, and we're listening to her try to explain about what happened last night.
Well, to be fair here, Kalila Brown-Dean is not a researcher or a pollster. I mean, she's not one of the people who was using data to try to prognosticate that stuff. We're probably more guilty of that than she is. But I think you've got the wrong person, if that's you think the problem is.
And I think that Kalila, as a political scientist, has her own views. I do, however, John, take your point, and I think we've said it a little bit before. Look, we in the media have gotten this incredibly wrong. I think a lot of people I've heard from this morning, Kalila, say, well, if we got it all so wrong, why on earth would then anybody listen to us about what should happen next? I will say that probably one of the things that the media does the worst is spends time trying to figure out what's going to happen as opposed to talking and analyzing the things that are happening and figuring out paths forward and ideas, the very sort of conversation that Colin is planning on having this afternoon at 1 o'clock. So I think maybe, Kalila, the idea of getting out of the business of trying to predict what's going to happen is something that we should all spend a little bit more time thinking about, because it just didn't work this time, did it?
So I think it's an interesting point from your caller, and as you have both said, I'm in no way connected to the polling. This isn't something that you can lay at my feet as I got wrong. What political scientists say always is that we should not be in the business of making these predictions. And so I'm someone who has been very skeptical from the beginning about our desire, not just in terms of media, but the demand from the public to make these predictions. Because the one thing that we know from decades of research, decades of scholarship and everyday political action is that the only thing that matters is what people do in the polling booth on that day, whether that's Tuesday here in Connecticut or early voting in other states across the country. And so that turnout can change based on the weather of the day, based on a new report, or based on a conversation that people have while waiting in line. So I think this is a moment for us to take a step back and to assess what happens now. So how much stock do we put into what people tell us officially versus the conversations that they have in private spaces or the echo chamber of what people view as being credible sources and ones that they see as having some doubt or some kind of agenda?
John, if you're still there, quick question for you. What do you think about President-elect Trump?
Well, I'm nervous. The markets have been down, and I think they probably will drop a bit on uncertainty. I'm a retired veteran, and that in no way drove my vote. I actually voted for Hillary, but honestly, I secretly wanted Trump to win because this country does need change. It's going in the wrong direction. The elites, Washington is in a quagmire, and they're not getting anything done. The country's literally falling apart at the seams, and I think Clinton would have been more of the same, and it just doesn't work.
Well, John, thank you very much for that. So a lot in what he just said, Suzanne, that I'd like you to maybe help me pull apart a little bit. First of all, boy, whether or not it was a year ago, a month ago, or this morning, I don't get the feeling that America is falling apart at the seams. I will say, though, that the reaction of the stock market last night and potentially this morning might tell us a little something about how segments of America view great uncertainty as it comes through the political process. So there's an awful lot there. I mean, what do you see in all that? The fact that, yeah, the stock market goes, oh, my goodness, President Trump. Then an awful lot of us are waking up this morning going, my goodness, how is this going to work? I mean, what do you read in there?
I think that you know, Hillary Clinton was the Wall Street candidate. So Donald Trump was not the Wall Street candidate. He's been very anti-trade, anti-globalization, you know, which a lot of the big corporations and people on Wall Street like, you know. And so he's very populist. He's also kind of a blank slate. We really don't know. And I think that's probably what Wall Street was reacting to this morning more than anything, is that lack of predictability. Who knows what his policies and administration are going to look like? He's not a policy wonk. He, you know, he had a few very clear things that he said throughout the campaign on immigration and trade. But, you know, all in all, I don't think we know that much.
The Mexican peso, Colin, fell enormously last night. The people of Mexico are clearly not happy about what happened. The part of the unpredictability, part of the disorder that perhaps comes out of this is the feeling of, okay, we've got a country that is one of our top trade partners to our south, where an awful lot of American jobs have gone, but also where an awful lot of American companies are invested, and they feel very uncertain about the possibility of a Donald Trump presidency.
Well, they should feel uncertain for all of the reasons that Suzanne says. And so ordinarily in a situation like this, what you would say, even if you had just elected somebody whose acumen you had reason to question, would be, well, somehow or other, there will be wiser heads around this person who will prevail upon this person to see things in a certain way, see things in a maybe more subtle or sophisticated way. One of the things that's a little bit alarming about Trump is his overall rejection of expertise over his own gut instincts. It just seems to – that pattern repeats itself over and over again, and certainly he's got nothing but disdain for the Warren Buffetts of this world. I'm not really sure who it is that can go there and talk to him and get listened to.
I do think, though, like his early circle looked a little alarming to me. He had a lot of very kind of young, inexperienced, a little bit fringy people. But as the campaign progressed, he kind of built a circle around him of policy people who were, I would say, more mainstream Republican than his initial group.
But his transition team has reached out to some very smart people that I know of, too. The question is, will he listen to those people at the level of policy?
And I just have to throw in a tweet from Jay, who I think was talking about something you'd said earlier, Suzanne, but just to that point. He says, how can it be a repudiation of elites? Trump's camp is filled with retreaded establishment types like Gingrich, Giuliani. I will add in, he didn't put this in, Chris Christie has helped. Chris Christie, the man who has Bridgegate in New Jersey happening at the same time that Donald Trump is taking over the presidency, is in charge nominally of helping him put together a new administration. He's part of it, but he is part of the elite, is he not? I mean, these are people who are part of the political establishment who have rallied around Donald Trump.
Sure, but like, you know, the numbers that Colin mentioned earlier in terms of the number of endorsements he got from, you know, people who were running this year, I mean, and then, you know, you've got all the former Republican presidents who didn't come out in support of him. And Paul Ryan famously has had some problems. You know, there have been some problems there as well. I mean, Trump was not the choice in terms of the elites, too. Who I'm really talking about are a lot of the big money backers. I mean, Hillary Clinton outspent Trump 2-1. And the money, the big money of the Republican Party did not follow Donald Trump. They didn't get – he didn't get that money. You know, I mean, the big funders didn't go with him.
Kalila?
But I don't understand why we define elites just in those terms of money backers. To me, an elite is someone who has access to privilege, who has access to decision-making, and can influence what happens. So if you are in a position where you can influence a bridge being shut down and backing up traffic for hours, you are an elite in a position of power. If you can be a Rudy Giuliani who has been out of elected office for a decade now and still be able to influence what happens and be out in front to talk about an FBI investigation, or to be a Newt Gingrich who has been out of office for decades and still is that close to those axes of power. So I think overall we all reject privilege when it's not our own. And we reject the idea that people have access when it's not the access that we enjoy. So it's not that Americans are fed up with the ruling class. It's about what ruling class is in place and how they can change that composition.
Well, and I think, too, I mean, it's not that all of the Republican elite left Donald Trump, right? Clearly he had some big name backers, but it wasn't the coalescing around him like there was on the Democratic side, and certainly not like there was with Romney and George W. Bush and some of these other people. He didn't have, you know, all of the, you know, the full establishment didn't get behind him like they have in the past.
But before I just quick thought from you, Colin, before we get to a phone call.
I'm reminded of the movie Dave, where Kevin Kline, you know, plays this guy who kind of takes over the presidency, and he's just kind of this regular guy. And at one point, he actually brings in Charles Grodin, I think it is, who's his accountant, who does, the guy who does his taxes to go over the budget, right? And the guy sits down and goes over there and explains why it can't work. And so that's what's not going to happen, all right? That's sort of our vision of the non-elite coming in here. And I don't see this election as rejection of elites. I mean, maybe it got framed that way for certain people. Maybe certain people think of it that way. As I said at the beginning, I think it's a rejection of stasis. It's a bunch of people who looked around and said, if I vote for Hillary Clinton, not very much is going to change in my life. If I vote for this guy, everything's going to change. And so that's what I'm going to do. I think both of them can be defined as elites. I mean, Donald Trump is, you know, however leveraged and semi-bankrupt he is, he's an incredibly wealthy elite. He's about as elite as they get.
In Manhattan.
Yeah.
He has his own planes and helicopters.
He
is the elite. It's for an entirely different conversation at some point. We'll just talk. Suzanne and I can have a one-on-one conversation about what exactly an elite is. We'll figure that out at some point. But for right now, let's go to Paul in Hartford. Hi, Paul.
Hey, how are you, John?
Good. What's up?
Well, with all due respect, I think that I'd like to share a different perspective on this analysis because I think you guys are missing the point.
Okay, sure.
I don't think this is about Trump. I don't think it's about Clinton. It never has been. It's about the 50 million, I didn't see the final tally, of elephants in the room that don't connect the dots. And this is people, who we are as people, psychologically who we are. It's not about demographics, and that's why the polls got it wrong, because they don't look at anything like that. They just look at age, income, race, geography, that kind of stuff.
So who are the 50 million? Tell me, Paul, what's up?
The 50 million people who are wired, hardwired, to look at things and take them at face value and not read between the lines. The most often heard comment that we heard from everybody this year was, I like the fact that he speaks his mind. Those are the folks that go, I like what he speaks, that he speaks his mind. But they don't naturally go, yeah, but what's on his mind? What does that mean? What are the consequences of that? We're going to ban a billion Muslims. Yeah, but the next question is, but how is that going to affect our standing in the world? How is that going to affect the war on terrorism? These are folks that are wired, hardwired, scientifically proven, hardwired not to connect the dots. That's why sound bites rule. Mm. I mean, when you said, you know, the reason why so many people like Trump is because there are so many people who are like Trump. I don't mean everybody, but a big, big number. And I think you guys are missing the point on this.
Well, I appreciate the thought very much, Paul. I want to get to another couple phone calls real quick because a lot of people want to join us. Rick's in New Fairfield. Hi, Rick. Rick's not even there anymore. Rick was just
somebody
like, you
go
know
check
what?
On, check on Rick. Somebody check, go if, check on Rick,
if
okay?
If you know a Rick
sure
in
okay.
New Fairfield, just to make absolutely sure. David in Woodbury. Hey, David.
Oh, hi, folks.
I knew you'd be there, David. What's up?
Oh, bless your heart. Hi, John. Donald Trump is going to be facing a class action of 4,000 people who paid tens of thousands of dollars for that fake university. and I don't think he'll be able to serve.
Well,
fraud is a felony.
Yeah, and you know what? It's David. It's really interesting. I don't think we've ever. I mean, one way or the other, Colin, we were going to have a president here who had the possibility of facing something like this. It is very true as we wake up this morning that there's any number of legal entanglements, not just the one that David mentioned, that Donald Trump has ahead of him, even before he takes the oath of office in January.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm finding it hard to be interested in that today. To me, there are some really large questions. And the large questions, my inclination is to look at the biggest possible picture and imagine the worst possible scenario. Imagine that Donald Trump cannot be prevailed upon by the people around him to be wise and to be fair. What do we do then? And oddly enough, I come out of that on a somewhat optimistic end. I really do think we all have the capacity by exercising our very best tendencies. I mean, you know, one thing to sort of say about all this is there are people in countries all over the world, people who have democratic leanings in non-democratic countries, who would still switch places with us today. You know, there are people who struggle against civic oppression that is considerably worse than Donald Trump is ever going to be able to make it, even in the worst four-year scenario that you can imagine. So, you know, I do feel like a few days of mourning and grieving and hanky-twisting is fine. But at a certain point, you know, you got to lift your head up and you got to lift your heart up and you got to say, all right, so what am I going to do to make this situation better?
So, Kalila, I'm going to take a break in a couple of minutes, but I really like your thought on this because I think it's one of the key parts. If we're going to talk about the really big things that we're thinking about today, I took Colin aside before this program because I feel like he and I have for years talked together on the radio and we've had a very diverse panel of interesting people who we talk about politics and news with. But we are at our core two middle-aged white guys of privilege who went to good universities and have degrees. And we are not typical of an awful lot of the conversation that is being had right now. Kalila, I think that one thing that I just want to talk about for a moment is that there are people across America, African-Americans and Muslims, Latinos, people perhaps who have family members who might face deportation or at least fear something like that, who are having a very different reaction than the one Colin just said. The idea that they are waking up in an America that they can feel rosy about is something foreign to them right at this moment. Help me through that a bit.
I think it's foreign to them, but I also think that we have to acknowledge where people are right now, not from a place of saying, what are you going to do to make this better, but to acknowledge the work that is being done so that there are people who are in families that they're not sure if that family structure is going to endure because they understand the hostility toward their families. They understand the hostility based on their religious identification. And I think a lot of that angst isn't really about Donald Trump. It is about the collective notion of what we saw yesterday. So that when you feel that hostility or that repudiation of your very basic being happens not just in a White House, but now in a Supreme Court, now within Congress, now within state-level decisions, that's important. And I think it's important for us to acknowledge it. It's important for us to not underestimate the gravity of that and to figure out also collectively what we can do, not to appease people, but to really look at the laws and policies that may fundamentally change how people live their lives and how they experience this time in our great country.
Did you have a thought, Suzanne?
Yeah, I think that my concern is that the people who voted for Hillary last night are going to feel like the Trump victory was some kind of hostile action toward Democrats or, you know, ethnic minorities, religious minorities. I don't think that's what it was. I think it was more self-interested than that, the vote. You know, I think people voted their pocketbooks. I think there is this kind of economic malaise in middle America that maybe we haven't talked about enough and that we haven't recognized.
But does it not come with a sidecar of some of those other things? The point is that economic malaise that people feel often comes, and again, I can speak from experience growing up in a place that is a very heavily Donald Trump territory in Western Pennsylvania, right? It comes not just with economic uncertainty. It comes with a tinge of the other being part of the problem that has caused that uncertainty.
Well, fear of the other, I think, is common when you're feeling, right, when you feel like someone else has taken your job and you want someone to blame. Sure, I think that does come with it. I don't think, I mean, the Trump voters that I know are not hostile to large groups of people. They're not bad people, you know. And I think this, if how do we get to this positive place that Colin's talking about if we want to cast half the country that voted for Donald Trump as bad people?
And that was the whole question from months ago with the basket of deplorables question, Colin. If indeed you throw a whole bunch of people in a basket without really getting a chance to talk to them first, how are we ever going to get any place?
Right. So much to say about this. And I don't want to seem like I'm underplaying some of the negative consequences here.
I didn't mean to set you up to do that. But
I think we're going to pull out of the Kyoto Accords right away as soon as he can. And that really, really worries me a lot. Climate change to me is one of the truly scary things. So, yeah, obviously, I'm hoping there can be some negotiation on Supreme Court appointments. If I were the Senate right now on both sides, I'd have a conversation. You know, maybe you confirm Merrick Garland now in return for a little bit of rhythm down the line from the Democrats. I don't know how that's going to work out, but that's obviously a very scary thing. Obamacare, I assume, is dead. I'm hoping this is one of the areas where Suzanne, my wish will have to happen over Suzanne's dead body. But I'm hoping that at the state level there can be some innovation. If I were Kevin Lembo and a bunch of other people, I would get a lot of really smart people, you know, sort of including Bill Curry and Bill Sebas and people like that, and start thinking about whether we could develop a public option, not a Colorado single payer style concept, but a public option here in Connecticut. Obamacare is gone. My son gets his health insurance through Obamacare. I don't know exactly.
I don't think all of Obamacare will be gone. I think parts of it will be kept, but I do think, I mean, look, it's failing anyway. I mean, the exchanges are like erupting as we speak.
Which is a good incentive to make something new, make something better.
Colorado had, a universal health care option on their ballot yesterday, and it got voted down, I mean, pretty soundly.
I think one of the reasons it's failing, well, this is too granular, totally our conversation, but one of the reasons it's failing is because it never did have a public option. But we'll talk about that some other day.
Well, I'll tell you what we're going to do is take a quick break. We're going to get some more thoughts from our panelists, who include Colin McEnroe from the Colin McEnroe Show, Suzanne Bates from the Yankee Institute, Kalila Brown-Dean from Quinnipiac University, and a few more quick phone calls. We are talking about the results from last night today on The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky, trying to pull apart what we saw last night in the presidential election and everything else that we saw across our state with Suzanne Bates, Kalila Brown-Dean, and Colin McEnroe. A couple quick phone calls because a lot of people want to join us. Jeff's in Coventry. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. I voted for Hillary Clinton, and I really like her as a person. But I think the biggest thing that happened was that we underestimated the animus out there against her. There's a lot of people that I talk to that are fairly reasonable that just do not like her. And I don't think I think that was really the major cause of all this. It wasn't that Trump won. She lost this. I feel like any other candidate could have beat Trump by 20 points. And probably any other Republican candidate could have beat Hillary by 20 points.
Hey Jeff, I think you're making a good point. Colin, I'll just say quickly, when we were out at our polling place in the morning, Jeff Cohen was out there with me. The very first voter we talked to was somebody who voted against Donald Trump. And we asked him about, you know, how excited he was about Hillary Clinton. He was not very excited. He voted for her. But I think that everything that Jeff's saying is pretty on the money.
Yeah, I mean, we'll debate this for centuries or at least decades. And there's a guy out in Western Connecticut who's been I don't know if I can say his name, because he's been very quietly collecting kind of oral testimony about this. And he travels to other parts of the country and he just asks anybody he meets, you know, what do you think of this election? And one of the things that he really – and he emails me. I must have gotten 35 emails from him, and they're very interesting. But, yeah, over and over again, you hear exactly what John said, this tremendous animus against Hillary Clinton. This is a very odd election in the sense that each candidate had the only opponent that candidate was capable of beating. I don't think Trump could have beaten a conventional Democrat, and I don't think Clinton would have done particularly well as she did against a conventional Republican. I also just want to quickly say, this is an underlooked thing, but something Jonathan keeps pointing out to me. These people are so old. You know? I mean, Ronald Reagan was younger when he was sworn in than Donald Trump is going to be. Hillary Clinton is of a similar age. Bernie Sanders is 75 years old. The two major party nominees, Trump and Clinton, neither one of them is able to operate a personal computer. They don't know how those work. this is like we just elected. We just had two dinosaurs fighting in front of us, you know, while the asteroid is whistling towards us.
Let me just ask you, Kalila. I mean, Taylor asks us, would the results have been different if Bernie was there? John asks, you know, what happened to all the progressives who turned out for Obama? I mean, did people just sit it out, do you think, because they weren't pleased with Hillary Clinton?
I think that questioning of Hillary Clinton was important. But if we look at the data from yesterday, those key core groups within that Obama umbrella were there yesterday. What we saw as being the key difference was about age. So younger people broke for Hillary Clinton, but Donald Trump really pulled that 30 and up base. That's different. The key demographic that no one's talking about is the high turnout and high vote for Trump amongst white women across the U.S. That is the key demographic that people weren't accounting for in the proper way. And I think some of that may have been a vote that was a rejection of Hillary Clinton, but also an embrace of these broader ideals. And I just want to be clear, in no way am I saying that people who voted for Donald Trump are bad. That's never been the issue. I think that we all vote based on self-interest, but how we calculate that self and what we see as being in opposition to self-interest is what's key.
I have to ask you, Suzanne, because we're running low on time. We haven't really gotten to what happened here in Connecticut. Kind of historic move by state Republicans into the state House. Now, they've not taken control of either chamber of the legislature. There's a tie in the state Senate now, 18-18. But there was a lot of movement in the state legislature as well. It seems as though even at the state and local level, there was an impact yesterday.
Right. Well, and I think, you know, I mean, I think a lot of people thought the Republicans in Connecticut would be hurt by Trump at the top of the ticket. I thought they usually don't do as well during in a year that's a presidential election year here in Connecticut. That's such a blue state. And we really are still such a blue state. But the Republicans in the state legislature did very well. And I think that says a lot more about what's happening here on the ground. I also think there's been a lot of talk lately about, you know, Hartford's potential bankruptcy and some of those other issues. And the talk about regionalization, you know, we talk a lot about these two Connecticuts, you know, the rich and the poor, but we really don't talk a lot about the middle class. There really aren't just two Connecticuts. And I think the middle class came out big yesterday for Republicans in Connecticut because they're afraid that their taxes are going to go up again. And so, you know, I think that might be part of what you saw yesterday as well.
Yeah. And I think that there really was a sentiment with some of these races calling for the state legislature. I mean, everyone was running against a very unpopular governor, Daniel Malloy, and the big budget deficits and some of the problems we're having in the state.
Yeah. And so as far as we know, it came out 18-18. We're still saying that, right? That didn't change. And in a way, it's not really 18-18 because with Joan Hartley and Paul Doyle, both Democrats can often be part of coalitions voting Republican. I wish it were 19-17. I wish the Republicans had full control of the Senate. I think it's good if both parties own all this stuff, have an ownership stake on all this. I mean, everything's broken, so there isn't like something really worth coveting. So let's share all the problems, see if we can come up with a solution that everybody can buy into.
Kalila, I'll give you the last thought, about 30 seconds or so. I mean, how do we build that coalition? How do we move forward, not just at the state level, but across the nation, to try to figure out ways to make things work now?
So I think what has to happen is that we have to be willing to have conversations with each other. So much of this campaign season was about people communicating through memes, through sort of negative comments, and not understanding what people were really feeling. Fear is powerful. Angst is powerful. I hope that can be a strength for us collectively in the state and across the country.
Suzanne, how about you? I mean, help us build a coalition here so that we feel like we're moving forward at the state level, at the national level.
I think part of the vote yesterday, too, there are a lot of people on the right who really don't like identity politics and they don't like dividing us up into these different categories. And I think that trying to find areas of commonality where we're not dividing ourselves up into different segments of voters and talking about issues and how to move the country forward together, I think that's uniting. So I'm hoping that we'll get more of that conversation.
Colin?
I think acknowledging also there are forces in the world that are more powerful than politics. And sometimes I think politics kind of got broken this time. I mean, all kinds of well-meaning people on both sides were not able to affect an outcome that most of us are comfortable living with, I think. And so there are other places to look. As Obi-Wan Kenobi said, if you strike me down, Darth, I will become more powerful than you can imagine. Use the Force, people. It's there.
You know, the Force is one thing that is always there. I want to thank Colin McEnroe, as always. He'll be talking more this afternoon at 1 o'clock. Also, Suzanne Bates from the Yankee Institute and Kalila Brown-Dean from Quinnipiac University. Keep the conversation going at WNPR.org. I'm John Dankosky. Thanks for joining us in the Wheelhouse.